Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Well, folks, we've got 1 minute before we go into break, and we're going to start our discussion with Paul Nally. Paul Nally has a long resume. He's obviously a little bit older than me, just a little bit, but he understands and has been practicing and actually trying to enforce or getting Georgia back into common law using common law courts, common law grand jury, trying to get the courts to become common law courts. And so we need to have this discussion. And actually, so what we've done is kind of created the foundation of, you know, him and common law and so forth. And in the next interview, we'll already talk about that up front because we only have a minute on, or two on the back end after this interview. This is a long, lengthy interview. So going into the next interview, we hope to actually start getting into what it takes to restoring, start connecting the dots and what it really takes, because it does take a bit of understanding and so forth. But we want to help you know that, or we want to let you know that there are entities and groups out here that are here to help you in creating your constitutional counties. You're not alone. So when we come right back after this music ends, I'll be interviewing Mr. Paul Nally, or Judge Nally, from the state of Georgia. We'll be right back after this quick second. Folks, we have Paul Nally. And as a matter of fact, because we haven't really gotten into the real details, how do you prefer to be called? Mr. Nally, Paul, Your Honor?
Oh, listen, let me explain something to you real quick. Because of my life experiences in and out of the law, right now, being called a judge is not for me exactly a badge of honor.
I get it.
Say that.
Okay. So should I just call you Paul, or should I just call you Mr. Nally? Because I believe...
Paul's fine.
Paul is
just
fine.
Just don't call me late for
supper. I won't call you late for supper. So, folks, the reason I've asked Paul to come on, and the reason this is a very important conversation, is we want to talk, and we need to talk about common law. And as I've been covering on the radio show, the importance of restoring our constitutional republic, and that we have to do this at the county level. It has to start at the county level. What we need to do is we need to restore common law courts at the county level first. Because once the counties start operating with common law, you will begin to learn how we can actually start sweeping through and cleaning up the state as well as the general government. And so understanding common law, what is this thing, and, you know, what does it do, and those types of things is why I've asked Paul for his time to come onto the show and dive into this. So without too much delay and getting into the personal pleasantries, if you don't mind me putting that aside, can you give us a, because we've kind of talked about this before, but hearing it from somebody else, because I've talked to, I don't know if you know who Brent Allen Winters is. I've had him on, and he's goes by the common law lawyer. But I would like to hear, because I think it's important to hear it in different terms, different ways. What is common law? So what is common law?
Common law has come in this system of government, refers to a system of judicial decisions that were arrived at many, many years ago, centuries ago, in England, and they were based initially upon local customs, practices, and usages. Now, of course, that started to evolve when written edicts came down, and then, of course, when Parliament came to issue their decrees, then those concepts were incorporated in the judicial decisions. But primarily, the common law is the body of judicial decisions that were arrived at in England. There is also what's known as an American common law, and those, of course, are found in the early decisions of our Supreme Court.
Well, so now...
So that is the basis for the concept of common law.
Now, when you say the Supreme Court, let me ask you this, because one of the things I do understand is, you know, the Constitution and its design. And one of the problems with the framers, I think Mason brought it up, and it was brought up in a couple of different of the debates. The fact was that the Constitution initially did not declare the law of the land to be common law. And as a matter of fact,
it did not.
Right. Right. Which is why. Go ahead.
Excuse the interruption, but that is not the case in the state of Georgia. Now, I can't speak to other states.
Correct. Each state had to specify what law, and as a matter of fact, every state in the union called for common law as the law of the land of that state, but except for Louisiana, they're the only ones that declared civil law. Go ahead.
That's correct. And in Georgia, we have a statute. It isn't in our constitution, but it is in our statute that the common law does exist in the state of Georgia. As it was in 17, I think it's 1787. I'd have to go back and pull the statute, but it's in Title I. But at any rate, and basically what has happened in this republic is our legislature and our courts, when laws are contemplated being enacted, one of the first things that some people do, not everybody, but some people, is that they go back to the common law and say, okay, what did the common law say about this? Then they'll take that language of that concept, and when they bring it over into the legislative branch of our government, they either adopt that same language, or they modify the language, or they may modernize the language and modify it to put it into our positive law, our written statutes. Excuse me, I'm having to stop a sneeze.
Okay. I hate that.
So anyway... that's the way that the common law becomes what we would call black letter law in our statutes. One of the nice things about the grand jury, and that, by the way, that is the focus of my efforts. One of the nice things about the grand jury is that in the Georgia Constitution, in our 1983 Constitution, the practice of the grand jury was always a matter of common law. But when the 1983 Constitution was ratified, the people in this state reached over into the common law and picked up the grand jury. And they set it down in our Constitution. But they did not set it down in the judicial articles, Article 6 in the Georgia Constitution. They didn't put it there. They put the grand jury and the trial juries in Article 1, which is our Georgia's definitions of rights, rights, privileges, and immunities. If you want to know what they are in Georgia, go to Article 1.
Okay.
And so they set the grand jury down fully clothed with all of the powers, duties, and responsibilities that were known to the common law and set them down. So if you want to know that, now there are some statutes, and unfortunately too many of them are unconstitutional. today that involve our grand jury. But basically, if a grand jury foreman and his fellow judges want to see and understand what has been the history of the grand jury in this particular instance, they got to go look at the common law. They can't go to statutes. And the proper way in Georgia to read any statute that involves the grand jury is if that statute says the grand jury shall, you cannot read that as a legislative command. You have to read that as the grand jury has the authority to.
Okay.
Because what they've done is they've gone back and they've said, okay, now the grand juries have done this in the history and the grand juries have done that, so we're going to bring those two in and we're going to put them in black letter law. They make the mistake of saying, using the phraseology, the grand jury shall. But they do not have authority under our Constitution to make any law that regulates a grand jury. It says so right there in our Constitution.
Right.
The legislature in the state of Georgia has the authority in our Constitution to provide by law for the selection and the compensation of grand jurors. And that's it. That's all they can legally do.
So let me get back to common law and the law of the land. In our form of government, a lot of people just refer to us as a Republican form of government. In other words, a lot of people really brush over what our government really is. And I try to help people understand that it's a little bit more complex than just saying it's a Republican form of government or it's a democracy or it is blah. And technically, we have different layers of government. And in our political system, as a matter of fact, in our Declaration of Rights, as Thomas Jefferson helped educate and helped declare, that governments are instituted by men, and that we, when we create government, we create a sovereignty. And in the American form of republicanism, because by definition, republicanism is a representative government, but in all nations in the world, representative government means representative of the people, except for America. America, during the Constitutional Convention, there was these debates on who deserved representation when they started going down this path of bicameral legislative bodies. And so it was Roger Sherman that injected this concept that clearly we the people are sovereigns. But do we not create a sovereignty when we create a government for ourselves at the county or at the state? Are our states not sovereign over those powers we've delegated to them? Or are we, the people, the constant sovereigns, then we are creating a democracy. So for us to truly have a Republican form of government, we must represent the sovereigns at the table of both sides, of the people and the governments that they've created. And therefore, this is why we created these bicameral legislative bodies. And so when we look at republicanism in America, republicanism is of the sovereignties of both the people and the governments that they've created, or the sub-elements of government. Because, at the point of the time of the Constitution, and forgive me for injecting all of this and going down this rat hole, but it's important. We had 13 states that were already created. There were new states that were around the corner that started to pop up, Kentucky, Vermont, and so forth. And so as these new states were being created, they were actually created by the counties. In other words, when these enabling acts went forward to actually say, we're going to recognize Kentucky and Tennessee and these new states, Congress sent out enabling acts, and they directed the counties to actually send delegates to a convention to create their constitution. So in other words, they recognized the importance in the formation that a state was formed by the government of the people of those counties. And I can get into the details of all of that. But the important part is what kind of government we have. And so in a constitutional republic, the other side of republicanism or a republican form of government isn't just representative. A republican form of government is based on law and hard-founded law. And so what we did in the Constitution was created, and it's right there in Article 6, the supreme law of the land. And inside that supreme law were delegated very specific powers and very specific roles and responsibilities, and all things that were not delegated to the federal government were left to the states. However, it didn't mean that the states could exercise general powers, because each state had a constitution, and the good people of those states, or the counties and the delegates that created those state constitutions, if they were smart, they didn't grant any general powers to their state government. They denned them very well and confined them to very specific enumerated powers. And so most states were that way. But as we started going down this this migration towards democracy, they started granting. And you'll find that most all general powers that the states have are unconstitutional because of their source. But I'll dive into that some other time. The important part is that even though we have a republican form of government, it is one that is based on the law. So common law has to actually look at what the law of the, not the land is, but that defined law that our government was created upon and moving forward. And then when we found, so this is the beautiful thing about common law, is that if we find something that is actually a violation of God's law and the law of nature, such as the this repugnant idea that if a slave, you know, runs away, because this is in the Constitution, and they get to another state, that state is obligated, even though they don't recognize slavery as, you know, as something humane, or, you know, because the northern states were refusing to actually abide by the Constitution. They said that violates our fundamental belief in the doctrine of all men are created equal. And so they actually started recognizing that one little part of the Constitution was a problem. And so what they could have done was they could have used either common law and started actually changing and then using an amendment to remove that instead of having to go through the Civil War. But back to this whole thing, common law actually allows us to examine the law itself when we've become enlightened to kind of recognize that there may be a real problem or a deficiency with the supreme law. Then common law can actually be used to help redefine, because it's not always just about indictments. It's about searching for the truth and the facts.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
And that is done. The interesting thing, and the origins of this, that I don't think that this is brought up yet, this goes back to ancient Israel, where Moses created the system of judges, where, you know, he delegated out, you know, this distributive power that, you know, most judgments would be done furthest away from him. And the higher, the bigger the problem is, it would, you know, move towards a central judge where they needed, you know, greater authority or what have you. But bottom line is, instead of having a theocracy, we have a, you know, a republican government, or, the, you know, the people being sovereign. We allowed this concept of a trial by jury, and that the jury would make these determinations instead of a judge.
Yes, sir.
And so anyway, it's a beautiful system, folks, and forgive me for injecting, but, you know, when people start talking about the government, the law, republican government, and that type of stuff, it's really important to try to help people understand that even in government form, right, you have a monarchy, because there's different ways we look at government. There's monarchies. We understand we've got a constitutional republic. But I point out every nation, even China, has a constitution and a republic. They call themselves a republic. The difference is that we have an enumerated constitution, and our republican form of government is completely different. Instead of actually being, because there's these other things called confederacies and federations, and most people look and say, well, America's a federation, when we're not. A federation is where the majority of all the power sits at the national level, where you create this federation like ancient Rome or Egypt. They had a federation that controlled the empire, We don't. We have a very limited, so we actually have more of a confederation than we do a federation. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so we have, so this is a hybrid. We have a hybrid that's been designed by the divine hand of providence that most people just marginalize when they say we have a constitutional republic or we have this or that. And so it becomes one of these, you know, it's that trigger word for me when we start talking about government. I really want people to understand that we have such a superior system that you really have to get your arms wrapped around this to understand the depth of protections that we have from the different layers of separations of power and checks and balances and so forth.
You know, one of the, now, if I may.
Go ahead, absolutely.
Situation here in Georgia. As you and I speak, a black friend of mine down in South Georgia, we're both prior military. He and I have been indicted by a Coffee County grand jury. Now, Coffee County is plumb at the other end of the state from me. But the reason that we happen to be indicted is because we heard of a former Marine down there who, and as some Marines do, they kind of sometimes lose control of their emotions.
Okay.
Not complete control now, mind you, but sometimes they say things they should have just stayed quiet about. But at any rate, he had a restraining order against him, and he's going down the road one day, and he sees the guy that he is restrained from, and he just hollers out the window, according to one witness, that I'm going to impeach you, and just kept on driving. Well, the people who he hollered at told the police. They called the police and told the police that he had threatened to kill them. So the police go arrest him, and they charge him with aggravated stalking, which is a felony in this state. But because he was also under a TPO, the judge revoked the remaining 6 months of his one-year TPO. So that meant he had to sit in jail for 6 months. Well, no big deal, because he can get a bond. He has a right to be bonded out after he has served his TPO time. So, anyway, the law in the state of Georgia says that if a grand jury has not acted on a case, then the individual, upon application to the court, shall be granted a bond. And it says in that very word, the judge shall grant a bond. Now, of course, that doesn't apply to murder. But in most every other case, that is bondable. If the grand jury hasn't acted in 90 days, the judge shall set a bond. Well, it so happens that 147 days after his arrest, the grand jury had not indicted him on the charge that the law enforcement officers had made. So he applies to the court for a bond in December, knowing that he's still going to have to stay in jail to January the 6th, but on the 7th, he can make bond and get out. Well, the judge refused to give him a bond. So that didn't sit well with me and Bobby Worthy, so we filed a petition. We didn't file. We submitted a petition to the grand jury, the September term of the grand jury, and we let them know that we were not happy with the judge refusing him a bond when the grand jury had not met and the law said the judge shall. And basically, we just accused the judge of violating his oath of office. Well, in Georgia, you got to understand, if you charge somebody with a felony in this state and that somebody happens to be a judge, you ain't going to be exactly looked on with the greatest of favor by some people. But that's what we did, and we charged him with violating his oath of office. And that, of course, if it went to trial, and if he were convicted, then the judge could sentence him to 5 years in the state penitentiary. But the grand jury, and I have to say the grand jurors here, I cannot speak to the prosecuting attorneys in that county, because on the record of this case so far, their hands are clean. There is no record of them interfering. But that grand jury turned around, and instead of holding that our petition to them had become moot by the time the grand jury considered it, and by the way, we filed it in March, they didn't consider it until May the 29th. But instead of holding that it was moot, or that they just simply didn't want to hear it, which they couldn't do legally anyway, instead of that, they turn around and indict us for false submission of official documents, of documents in an official court proceeding in the state of Georgia. Well, that's a 20-year felony.
Interesting.
Well, what you got to understand is they're sending a message. You want to come down here and mess with our judges? We like them just like they are. You need to stay the heck out of Coffee County. Well, the reason I can make that assumption is because we were not officially notified by any sheriff's department that we were indicted. We had to hear it through the grapevine. So what Bobby and I did is we just went and got us a property bond, and both of us drove down to Coffee County, walked in the jail, grinning from ear to ear, and told the security guard, "We're here to turn ourselves in. Who the heck are y'all?" Well, there's bench warrants out for us. Well, one thing led to another. Now, this is, we turned ourselves in on June the 4th last year. And as you and I are talking right now, we have not had an arraignment.
Interesting.
They don't want us in Coffee County. And the reason they don't is because of the 14th Amendment and an inconvenient Supreme Court case called New York Times v. Sullivan. And what a lot of people don't understand is that the 14th Amendment, Section 1, Clause 2, is very explicit.
Privileges and Immunities Clause, yes.
No state shall enforce any law which abridges the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States.
That's right.
Well, that's exactly what that grand jury did.
So, and my audience is really, really well informed on the 14th Amendment. So,
good.
So interesting.
Good.
So let me get back to, because really, I am pushing to try to help people understand what it takes. Now, one of the things that, and this isn't a gotcha question, and I'm bringing this up because I don't like letting people, because I think it's important that we, you know, go through paradigms and actually then, as we're looking, you know, pointing to different ways to see things. One of the things I remember in our latest engagement before you came onto the show was, you know, what does it take? And you said it's going to take a lot of time and education to restore common law courts and, you know, to restore common law in the land. And I do understand that it does take some education. But what I like to point out is I think the Lord can work in miraculous ways. And there are two really good examples in the Bible that talk about ways of changing a culture, because that's what we're talking about. We have a corrupted culture right now, and how can we change our culture? Well, there's the Mosaic changing of the culture, which literally took 40 years wandering in the desert for a generation to die off, where the younger generation witnessed all of these miracles and understood the power of God. And so that's what it took for them, because it's not that they weren't ready. You know, God said they were ready to go, but because they were so, hard-headed, God said, okay, that generation is going to die off, and we'll just let the new generation, and you can wander for 40 years. And so there's that process of changing the culture, which is a very slow, and it's an educational process, and getting rid of the paradigms that, pre-exist from the earlier generation. I also like to point out the story of Jonah, because if you look at Jonah and that story, there's a lot more to it than just Jonah showing up at the Philistines' gates and saying, you're all going to die. What he did in his message, he delivered a paradigm shift that actually shifted the Philistines into actually repenting and recognizing God and becoming an obedient culture, just like that. Now, I believe that we have the ability to kind of have, and I believe that the Lord can, do things in any way he wants to. I honestly believe that we can start instituting common law in a much quicker fashion. And I believe that we can be smarter instead of having to go through, because we tend to go through the processes that we're familiar with. And the process that we're familiar with is, educating everybody. And everybody that I have sat down and talked to, because I've talked to lots of people, and you don't know about Republic Review, any of the things I'm doing, which is okay. It's not required, for people to function and live. I mean, everybody can live happily without knowing what I'm doing. But what's really important is that when we sit down and I'm saying that we have the ability to fix these problems rather quickly, and people say, no, we have to educate. And then I point to this mosaic process of what they're basically referring to, that everybody has, we have to get enough of the people educated. Now, the difference between Moses's time and today's time is Moses had unattested access to the people. He didn't have a mainstream media. He didn't have a national education system. He didn't have all of these evil vestiges throughout his society that he was wandering through the desert with, that was indoctrinating his people. He had unattested access, so he could actually save them from the bites of the asp. He could feed them with manna. He could do all of these different miracles, or actually the Lord did. And the Lord used Moses to help teach people, God's power and his love for them. And so that took a lot of time. But he had unattested access. Today, we don't have that. And so when I sit down and I get into – it doesn't take long for me to just bring this question forward. I go, how much time do you think it'll take to go – understanding that we have to fight the mainstream media. We have to fight the national education system. We have to fight all of these different things to go down your path of educating. And I say, do you think we have enough time? And it always comes down to the clarity of no, we don't have enough time. So don't you think it's time we start getting smarter and thinking out of the box and actually going to the Lord and saying, give us some shock value, give us some Jonahs, give us the opportunity to help shift the paradigms.
Sometimes that is exactly what needs to happen.
Right. And I think
consciousness of the people needs to be shook violently.
Yes.
And for them to stop and say, wait a minute, how did this occur? Why did this occur?
Now, for clear...
Once they start asking questions, but the problem is getting them to ask the questions.
Right, so let me do a little disclosure here, because I believe that you are not a professional common law person going out and selling books and making a living out of, making an enterprise out of converting people into common law and understanding it. Is that not correct?
Exactly correct.
Okay, so my point is, because this is one of the things that I can't I can't judge a person for trying to make a living or for trying to at least take care of their family and so forth. And if you can make a living doing something, such as, you know, some people make a living out of being a pastor or a minister or what have you. But I tell people that when all of a sudden your income is now based on doing something, how likely are you to actually say, you know, hey, here's a solution, and you know what? This solution actually gets rid of the problem, you know, within a matter of a year or instantly or what have you. And you realize that if this solution is invoked, because I've actually seen this happen when I've talked about Republic Review and what I'm doing, and I share this with people who have created their own institutes of education and so forth, they quickly make the connection that, oh, well, this guy's talking about actually obsoleting what I do. I'd no longer be able to make money at what I do.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, there's their what we call their self-preservation, their need to, you know, put food on the table would actually shift. In other words, it's like killing the goose that lays the golden egg. And so I run into this all the time, but you're not one of those people. You're not in that position to say, you know, hey, let's kill that goose, because that goose is actually feeding both sides, both what we would call good and evil. One of the things that I also do, and this is how I kind of help people see these things, it's metaphorically. If you look at the majority of all of our problems, have come from social engineering and manipulation and design that's reached all the way back to the 1800s. And I even prove this on my radio show every Christmas time. Not that I'm trying to kick Santa in the teeth, but I show people that the Christmas that we know today has been brought forward, whether it be by noble intent or not, it was brought forward as a manipulation in changing behavior in the United States. Most people don't understand this. And so... And so anyway, correct. So anyway, as I kind of share these paradigms of, you know, manipulation and management and so forth, what I try to get people to understand is when you look at, you know, how government and how the controllers have used social engineering, and in today's environment, when we look at the countering in, you know, if we look at the people who are fighting abortion, the people that are fighting health freedom, or, you know, wanting and fighting for their health freedom and fighting against the social engineering, all they're doing is they're doing a counter social engineering. They're not striking at the problem, the root of the problem. And as Thoreau stated, thousands hack at the branch of evil, but only one strikes at the root.
Yes.
And so what I'm trying to get people to start realizing, you know, yeah, you can go hack, you can actually make a living, and maybe, you know, you'll be okay, because there have been lots of people that have been doing this for years and years and years, but I don't think we have the time. And I think that you may be involved and engaged in something that you think is a good thing because you're hacking against evil and you're doing your own good social engineering to deprogram people from this one little thing you're fighting, but you're not solving the problem. And so getting out of this big philosophical, metaphorical, you know, space now and getting back to the common law thing and understanding this. So what I'm looking to help people understand is, what does it take? And so here's a question I have, because we're kind of looking at this, and let's say we're shoulder to shoulder and we're looking, you know, at the sunrise, and, you know, now we have a different perspective, because before we were on the beach and now we're up on the top of the mountain. So our view of the sunrise is a lot different, less obstructed and so forth. And so now we have the opportunity to see something maybe in a different way. I'd like to inject that I believe that if we can start convincing, I'll just say, clergy or people of faith to start learning and understanding, because common law is not rocket science. Do you not agree? It's not difficult to grasp. It just takes time to read the details of what it is, why, how it's formed, and what we need to do to, because we have to, you know, understand it. We also have to understand our existing system and what it really is and how it's not common law. Go ahead.
All is common sense.
Yeah. Yes, that's a very curt way of saying it. So,
sadly, too many of our neighbors don't possess enough of that, but they can be helped.
Correct.
You know, it's kind of like using the word ignorance. You know, you might look at somebody who's speaking about something, and they'll say something really stupid, and you'll look at them and say, "Well, you're ignorant." Well, you're not necessarily being pejorative in the use of that word. You're simply stating a fact.
Right. Yes. Well, so
now indifference to ignorance, that's a whole different matter.
Right. So in the interest of time, because we're running close to running out of time on this segment, and the reason I'm bringing this up now, and I think that this kind of helps, because I think it'll help set the stage in the next conversation that we have, because I would like to have you on a few times, as much time as one you'll give me, and as much time as, you know, it's necessary, so that we can, you know, because I believe reasonable people equally informed seldom disagree, and as long as we're equally informed, I think we're going to find common ground that we can actually agree upon, move forward, and work together. And so...
Absolutely.
And so, so here we go. What I would think and what I would like to actually plant and have you, you know, because obviously we can't come back to this in doing, you know, ending the segment and going straight into it, because it takes time. And I'd like to actually get you to ponder, you know, what would it take? Would it take clergy? What, you know, who are the people? Would it be the sheriff? Would it be specific people that we could elect that could understand and help? Because I believe training trainers. I've learned a long time ago that if you can teach people that are really good at educating, and believe it or not, politicians, if you get a good nurturing person to become a politician, you actually brought in somebody that can teach people and bring people up to understand what needs to be done as a good leader, as a good politician. I mean, politicians, we just have this carte blanche, you know, label that all these guys are snakes in the grass, you know, just like lawyers and so forth. They're just bad people. And I don't, that's because we gravitate towards the bad politicians, but there are good politicians, and we need to start helping them and help nurturing them so that they can start serving us, because that's what we need. We need public servants, not self-servants.
Amen.
So anyway, what I would like to propose is for you to ponder on how can we accelerate this, because I understand the paradigm that it takes time. There's a lot of illiteracy and ignorance, but I don't think this is rocket science. I don't think this is computer tech science or, you know, quantum science. This is something that I think the average person can, because you're right, it is common sense. And so what I'd like to do is when we get back together again, you know, I would like to hear some of your ideas and some ways that we can innovate or we can change the paradigms at the county level. And so prior to that, what I'd like to actually do is I'd like to share with you some of these concepts of building constitutional counties and so forth, but I don't have time in this segment to do that, because I think it's really important when somebody says a constitutional county, there should be a criteria to that, and I believe common law is one of those criterias. It's not constitutional unless they're practicing, and the court system, their law system, is based on common law. And so,
yes.
And that's just one of the many things. There's a couple of other things that are a part of that criteria for a constitutional county. And I think once we actually actualize things, we get our arms around stuff, and then we say this is what it should be, then people actually go, well, you know what, you're absolutely right. Now we can start kicking the tires, because until we actually build the car, nobody knows what this vehicle is going to be.
Yep.
And we already know what the components are that we have to have to get back to that. At least that's why I don't think this is rocket science. We already know most of these things, and we're just missing the fact that we're missing these integral things like the engines, the wheels, and the thing that actually makes that a vehicle. Anyway.
Yes. Now, if I may interject briefly here.
Sure, go ahead.
One comment. I would hope that your listening audience would understand that it is not, although we all recognize that educating our neighbors is absolutely essential, the fact is you're not going to educate 100%.
That's right.
But you don't even need 50%.
They didn't have 50% back in the framers' days. There were so many people that were illiterate, they didn't understand that stuff.
Well, you know, think back to the example given us at Gideon's spring. You know, the whole host of Israel was drawn up there to that spring, and all he said was, "Is go take a drink." But the manner in which they drank from that spring told him, "This is the man you need on your force for tomorrow morning, and that man needs to stay back in camp." Well, when he was through, out of thousands of Israelites, he had 300 men, and that's all God needed.
Yep.
Well, you don't necessarily need 300 men. And then, of course, there's Thermopylae, you know,
sure,
where the Greeks, the stand of the 300 Spartans, held off the entire Persian army.
Uh-huh. Yep, absolutely.
You can accomplish a great deal with a few dedicated men and women who understand what they're doing and how to do it.
Right. That's right. So, anyway, what I'd love to do, and we'll have to work out a schedule to have you back, but what I'd love to do is have that conversation. But what I'll do is I will try to preload in a separate conversation offline. That way we don't have to take up your time and, you know, going over things that my audience is really kind of well aware of. And what I'd like to do is kind of give you this process of restoring and creating these constitutional counties, and then we can actually start going into, you know, these innovative ideas of raising up, having people drink from that fountain and identifying who these people are and how to actually start injecting this concept of restoring common law courts, militias, and citizen vigilance, all of these types of things that are essential for a constitutional county. Anyway,
yes, sir.
If there's anything else, what I'd like to do is I will put links or any information that you might have as far as reading and that type of stuff, if you have some. And if not,
did I by any chance send you a transcript of the Chatham County Grand Jury of 1791?
I think you may have, and if you did, I can post that. And what I'll do is I'll post that on my Red State Talk Radio podcast page, folks. So whatever you have, if you want me to put something up so people can kind of start reading and understanding common law and or a good case point that you can talk to in our next segment, that would be awesome. I would really appreciate that.
All right, young man.
All right.
Well, it has been a pleasure on this end.
Absolutely. And don't go away real quick. We're going to go to break, and then we'll kind of say the final pleasantries and try to work out a schedule. But thank you so much for your time, and thank you for the willingness of coming on to probably one of the hardest radio stations for people to want to come on to, because I guess I intimidate some people. You didn't know that, so that's awesome. Anyway, folks,
I don't react too well to intimidation, and if you don't believe that.
I do believe that. But anyway, folks, we will be right back after this break. We're going to go into a break, and I'll come right back with no promos. We'll be right back. Thank you so much. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, so what's a promo between friends? I didn't realize, because I had no idea how much time I had left. And even though I only got 2 minutes left, I mean, how important is it to let people understand that Republic Review has nothing to do with the Convention of States? I think that's critical. I think people need to start to understand the Republic Review is basically exerting the authority and power that the states already have over their Constitution. It's innate. It is innate within the contract itself, because they are the only parties to it. This is a paradigm that Madison shared, that nobody understood this. It's hard to get people to understand this today. Most people think, oh, well, you got to put it in the... No, the only thing that went into that Constitution were those things that were specifically delegated to the federal government. We didn't put everything that, you know, well, the states can do these things. We actually did put some specific restrictions upon the states in the Constitution, but that's it. I mean, this is not hard, folks, that the states have all the authority, all the juice, all the power necessary enforcing their subcontractor, their child, the thing that they created, accountable. Now, I don't have time. I literally do not have time to, you know, go into the rest of the petitions that I didn't get a chance to finish regarding this intellectual property and patents. That's right. So I'm hoping, and I don't know if I can actually, between today and tomorrow, actually have another conversation with Paul, but we hope to actually capture that, and then we'll come back to common law. And so when we come back in our next episode, we're going to plow forward regarding defining bills of attainder and punishment and defining ex post facto laws. We're going to dive into citizenship. What is citizenship really? Where is the standards? What the federal government actually created these acts on citizenship. And what we want to do is we want to actually share these things. It was 1790, 1792. They started delineating and defining exactly what a citizen was. So understanding how everything was defined helps us get to ground zero, because as we moved away from that, it was all done unconstitutionally. And we're here to help you understand that. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.